countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal, bringing 295,000 readers the latest farming news and the best of rural Ireland weekly. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal, bringing 295,000 readers the latest farming news and the best of rural Ireland weekly.
Good morning and welcome to the programme. Coming up between now and 9 o'clock, we meet a farming family fostering children in Monaghan. Seamus O'Rourke is still worried about that hard border, how COVID has driven us cracked about eggs, and why the Irish farmers are so unhealthy.
Text 51551, email countrywide at rte.ie, and tweet at RTE Countrywide.
But first,
first thing happened, the plane came over the pitch, came down very low and circled around over the plane pitch, went away. It was there, gave the signal, of course, that the game was on. In a few minutes, it was surrounded and they started shooting. They came in like in alligators. Five or six tens, and they fired five or six shots in quick succession. Like, all the crowd were rushing around inside the canal gate.
This very day, 100 years ago, at around 9 a.m. in the morning, 15 soldiers, spies and civilians were shot dead by the IRA in Dublin in an attempt to disable the British military intelligence operation. That afternoon, in a raid on the Dublin Tipperary Challenge football game at Croke Park, the RIC opened fire and 14 people were killed, one player and 13 fans, including two Dublin boys aged 10 and 11. Now, there are many events planned this week to mark the centenary of the day now known as Bloody Sunday 1920. And in County Kildare, the GAA is honouring a man called Mick Salmon, who was very central to events that day as well. And joining me now is Owen Corrie, journalist and GAA historian. Owen, great to have you. Good morning.
Good morning.
So who was Mick Salmon?
Well, we had four very strong Kildare connections with the Bloody Sunday. Matthew Byrne is on the current Kildare team. His great-great-grandfather, James Matthews, was one of the Dublin victims. There was a player, Frank Burke, who was the successor to Pádraig Pearse as headmaster of St Enda's. He was marking Mike Hogan on the Dublin team on the day. Some people who've been following the story will know that revolvers were found. They were subsequently mentioned a lot in the House of Commons as a justification for the massacre. They were all dropped by Joe Steins from Newbridge, who was had been given the guns by Michael Collins to hold and wasn't supposed to be in Croke Park. But the most important and the key to the events of the day, because not only was he referee, but he was a major fundraiser for the dependents of prisoners, was Michael Salmon. And he was standing very close to where Mike Hogan and Frank Burke were on the day and crawled to safety when the shooting started. Sadly, that's where Mike Hogan died, and someone who came to his whisper an act of contrition into Mike Hogan's ear was also shot, one of the spectators from Wexford.
So Mick Salmon was the referee that day. He had won an All-Ireland with Kildare the previous year. It wasn't unusual for players to become inter-county referees at that stage and in years after. What were his recollections of the day? He survived.
He talked about crawling to safety, about the his escape afterwards through the gardens, as a lot of the people from Croke Park did, climbing wall after wall of those gardens that are still there around Jones's Road. But he spoke very little, which is quite interesting, that he was such a very gregarious character. He had was a publican. He just acquired in the same month as Bloody Sunday what is now the Pearl Bar in Fleet Street in Dublin. Listeners will be familiar with it. A lot of people in North Kildare would remember him. He died relatively young in 1947, but a great storyteller, very involved in dog racing and horse racing. Barry Brogan, the jockey and now a horse trainer, would be his grandson. And all of that happened, you know, with this context of Bloody Sunday in the background. And when it came to his funeral, very many people never knew he'd been referee. He kept quiet about it. And to some extent, that has obscured the events to commemorate him, because while some of the players have been very associated, the names associated with Bloody Sunday, Mick Salmon somehow fell out of the narrative.
You say he didn't talk about it, whether that was because obviously the trauma of the events were something he did not wish to remember. Having said all that, he continued in business and he did continue to referee.
Very much. He was one of the more prominent referees of the early 1920s. As you say, something that doesn't happen very much now, prominent players, inter-county players, could end up, in some cases, refereeing the All-Ireland semi-final to meet their team in the All-Ireland final. That continued right up to the 1940s. Players like John Joe Riley would have been refereeing and playing at the same time. It's no longer that common, and one of the reasons would be that there were accusations that, you know, a current player wasn't best because of the various rivalries. That was never levelled against Michael Salmon. He refereed an All-Ireland semi-final, very highly thought of, and refereed right up to 1938. And as you know, the best referees are the ones that nobody notices during a match. It's quite interesting to go through the matches he refereed. He would not have been an interventionist referee, and intervention by GA referees at the time would be very limited. You would get maybe 13, 16, 20 frees at most in a match. Most of them only had 6 or 7 free kicks. The football was much more robust, and you ask anybody, ask their grandfather about what it was like in their time, and referees didn't award that many frees. He was would have been probably better known as a referee at the end of his life, but we've got to remember, Kildare only have 4 All-Irelands, and he was part of one of the most famous midfield combinations in the history of the game, alongside Larry Stanley, in the Kildare team that won the All-Ireland in 1919. When you think that he was involved in the movement, he had gone to jail because of his role in the Irish Volunteers, these guys were sometimes on the run, sometimes in and out of jail, and they were playing and training at full inter-county level, winning All-Irelands. It's quite a remarkable story that the GA has in the heart of that struggle for independence.
And Mick Salmon is certainly not being forgotten by the county board in Kildare, particularly this year and from now on.
We're going to have the plaque for the referee at the county final commemorating Mick Salmon. So forevermore, we will have a Mick Salmon award, and that will really give him his rightful place. He was pretty much a poster boy for the revolution, not just in Kildare, but he was handsome, athletic. He'd won 100 metre sprints, won athletics championships, refereeing, involved in committees. He would have been on the committee for the Tailteann Games in 1924, very big deal at the time. Really selfless. These guys, sometimes they didn't get paid for what they did, either for the independence movement or for the GA, and sometimes it cost them a lot in terms of their life and their in and out of prison. So that selflessness will be remembered forevermore, as I say, because Mick Salmon, the referee's award, will be named in his honour. And I think that more he wasn't a man who went around courting in his lifetime recognition. I think that the long overdue recognition can be given to him 100 years after his participation in one of the most famous events in international sporting and revolutionary history.
Yeah, and it is quite extraordinary that, well, it's not unusual, as we know, for Dublin to be in a provincial final, as they'd be playing Meath this weekend, but it is a little bit unusual in the modern era for Tipperary to be in a football final. And in the year of COVID, here we have 2 provincial finals on the same weekend, 100 years later, and both Tipperary and Dublin will actually be playing this weekend. It really is extraordinary, isn't it, Owen?
extraordinary. And Tipperary, you know, in our lifetime would not be associated with football. At that time, they were. They were pretty much a power. If you drew Tipperary in the Championship, you were going to get a match. They were going for their fourth All-Ireland when they played in the 1920 All-Ireland was eventually played, the delayed match. Mm-hmm. A little short piece of footage can be found on YouTube from British Pathé, and you can see the team there with Dan Breen, who was throwing in the ball. We'd come to the truce at that stage. Mm-hmm. Civil War hadn't started. He was in the middle of them all, and R.D. Walsh in his Free State uniform off to the right. Fine, athletic, handsome young men, very, very fit. And they were a formidable football team. Tipperary's concentration has been on hurling ever since, but there's absolutely no reason why they couldn't be a powerful dual county in the way that Cork became and Galway became, and maybe we're beginning to see the stirrings of that again.
Well, we are, and of course Tipperary hurlers, we can't forget, are also have a big game today in the All-Ireland quarter-final against Galway. Owen, it's been lovely talking to you. Thank you very much indeed.
Always
for that.
Always a pleasure.
And we'll chat to you again, and thanks for giving us that Kildare insight into Bloody Sunday. By the way, the History Show has a special edition about Bloody Sunday on RTE Radio 1 tomorrow Sunday just after 6 p.m. Speaking of Kildare, Brenda, is that news to you?
Do you know what? There's a vague memory of it. There's something there, but to have it told so clearly is amazing. So in a way, it is kind of news to me. It's fascinating being from Kildare and supporting mm-hmm. Kildare and kind of hoping again that we rally for next year and all of that. But I'm so glad that there is going to be a referee award for Mick Salmon. Mm. I actually feel quite emotional about it. I really am glad for his family and his grandchildren and all that, that he is going to be recognised.
Yeah, and it's a way of recognising indeed the voluntary role and often the thankless role that referees play week in, week out at all levels in the GAA, indeed in other sports. That's not what you're here to talk about this morning, Brenda, because you've been to County Monaghan this week to meet a very interesting family.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a family and they foster children. So with COVID, it has impacted an awful lot on Tulsa's fostering services, you know, by slowing down the assessment, the training, the communication process for all involved. So they had a campaign just to let people know that they need children to be fostered still. In Ireland, there's nearly 6,000 children in care and 4,124 of them are with foster families. So with that in mind, I thought I would meet a family who farm, but also foster. And by God, did I meet the most gorgeous family. I went down to a place called Ahabog near New Bliss in County Monaghan.
Well, yep.
And I met the Brady family. And there is Sean and Sheedy, their mother and father. Love the name Sheedy, by the way. Basically, she was called Kathleen, but her younger brother couldn't pronounce it. Called her Sheedy. The name stuck. And it suits her. And they have two grown-up children of their own. But over the course of 20 years, they have fostered 35 children. They also run a very busy pig farm. So when I went to visit them, it was a really busy house because their own children were there. Some of the foster children they visit were there. And they also had brought some of the little baby piglets who'd been born on their pig farm that morning. So I wanted to get a sense of why they wanted to give up so much in their lives to other children and what it brought to them. And how is a farm a good place to actually foster children?
Yeah, we have a small pig farm in County Monaghan, nothing major. Myself and my son run the farm. We're just trying to build it up a wee bit further. We put up a mill there lately.
Sheedy, what are you holding there?
A Duroc, a little Duroc.
We leave the little baby piglets down for a while and we can talk about fostering and your family experience with
them. That's fine, Brendan. Yeah, no bother. We'll put them down. Our children were 11 and 13. And we decided that that was probably a good time for us to get started because, and we said that whenever we approached Tusla, that we wouldn't take any children older than our own. And then eventually we ended up with three long-term placements.
The challenge for me probably was trying to make them feel home from home and make them happy and meet their needs. And I love children and I loved having them.
The children would often be coming to you from a traumatic situation. What was that like for you, or can you remember that, Sean?
Look, we gave them a bit of room, a bit of space. We weren't overcrowding them. They got a time limit and sort of thing to sort of adapt to our house before we got into the nitty gritty. So why they were with us, or and if they wanted to talk, and if they didn't want to talk, they didn't have to talk. We were caring for them and we were trying to give them as much love as we could.
One of the things that people often think about is how difficult it must be to let them go when they want to move on themselves. How have you dealt with that, or how difficult has that been, Sean?
I felt that it was harder on Chidi whenever children went back, because she's with them 24/7, but that's what fostering's about. You do your spell, if they move on, that you've done all you can, you can't do any more.
No, you would feel lonely, you'd be heartbroken, many's a tear I dropped, but you just hope that there's a little positive taken and that helps me throughout the day.
Some of the foster children who come down to you would have come from city living. So is it much different to come down here to the pig farm? I mean, they're adapting to a lot, but is a farm a good place to foster children?
I think it's brilliant because the interaction that they have with these animals, they're probably never, they might have been in the zoo or whatever like that, but when you're actually holding these animals and caring for them and that, you can see the warmth that's in children, and it might only come out then when they're holding a pig or holding whatever, or a calf or whatever. There's so much goodness in all children, and that's where they learn an awful lot, because you have losses on the farm, you know, you have births, your factory, it's just a whole process, and they learn that. And the one thing I will say about the farming end of it is, a farm is a life skill, and that's what's brilliant for them on the farm.
When they're working on the farm, they're relaxed and they're, you know, getting on with the work, and the next thing they might say, oh, well, they'll tell you something that happened, and the next thing you find, oh, they'll say, oh, I remember I did this or I did that, some wee thing will come out on the farm.
It opens it up.
What I'm trying to say is they relax and they become more open.
What would you both say that fostering children has brought to your own lives, both as a couple, as individuals, for your family?
It has been a wonderful experience to have somebody else, but I think there's no greater satisfaction than seeing a child grow from a baby, let's say. In our case, we had children from 1.5, they're now 21, and see them growing up alongside your own children and doing all the things that a child should do and develop at certain levels, junior cert, leaving cert, college or whatever. You know, that's probably the brilliant thing. And they're not yours, but they're yours. They're not yours by name, but they're yours. I think that's it.
They're not yours, but they're yours, says Sean. Brenda, you still, you said it was a big house. Did you speak to anybody else?
I did. What a gorgeous sentence. Yeah. They're yours, but they're not yours. It sums it up so beautifully, their attitude to all the children that have been in and out. Remember, they've had children maybe for a week, maybe for a weekend, maybe for a month, a year. And all of them, I presume, go off and they feel better for being on the farm with Sean and Sheedy. And you can just tell. And one of those I spoke to is Tegan. And Tegan has been fostered by the Bradys on a long-term basis since she was 5 years old. She's now 21. She herself is a young mother to 8-month-old Mason. And she told me about her experience of foster care and living on the Brady farm. But we had to show Mason the piglets first.
Look at the piggy. Watch the wee piggy. Look. What's the piggy doing?
I think Tegan Mason is more interested in my microphone than the piggy.
I think so too.
Tegan, tell me, how old are you and how long are you fostered here?
I'm 21 and I've been here full time since I was 5 or 6, so 16 years. There's 8 in my family, in my original family. We lived in the town and I suppose it was just difficult times at that time, so I was tuck here and I'm getting on very well and have been this last 16 years. Brenda, I think life would have been a lot different. I would have went a completely different path. There probably would have been a lot of drinking and drugs. I suppose in a town there is a lot of that. I know you can get that in the countryside too, but it wasn't in the town. Also, Chidi and Sean did support me a lot through my teenage years. I was a bit of a hard teenager. But we all are. We all go through that teenage phase, and I know myself that if I had been living in the town, I would have turned out a lot different to the way I have turned out.
So Tegan, you've become a young mum to Mason. As a mother, do you now look at, say, the work that Chidi and Sean have done and the effort in a different way? Has it changed your outlook?
Yeah, definitely. I suppose that is the thing that has made me look at a lot of things different, because before I became a mummy, I suppose I was still a little bit up and down about the whole fostering situation. But when I did become a mummy, I kind of realised that people are just there to help you and to be there for you and care for you. As I've said, Judy and Sean have always done their very best, and I would be always grateful for that.
I can see, Sheedy, you're so proud of her.
Yes, I'm delighted to see that. Tegan is fit to talk and very confident.
Tegan is my second daughter, really. Tegan knows where she stands with me.
Tegan, over the years that you've been here, what has it brought to your life and done for you?
I suppose it's brought hope, love and care. If I hadn't of been in foster care in the first place, I wouldn't probably have got a lot of any of them three things that I'm only after naming out. When you're going through rough patches with parents, whatever, there isn't a lot of hope. You don't think that you're going to get anywhere in life. I know I was only young. I was only 5 and 6 years of age. But at that age, you still feel things. And I didn't feel like there was a lot of hope in my life. There was nobody there to guide me. And when I came to Judy and Sean's house, it was always positive thoughts, positive comments that were given. And that has helped me through my life. It is and has been amazing for me. I'd like to thank Judy and Sean for the care, love that they have brought to me and to my life. And I suppose I can say that on behalf of my brother as well, that also was in foster care with me. So I would like to thank the two of you.
That's a very good team.
I can't believe it. After all the ups and downs, and I still get a good...
Say lots of tears there, Brenda.
But you know what? I'm just thinking of them right now. They're probably all listening to this on the radio and they're sitting in their kitchen table on the farm and they're probably all in tears because you
tears
can tell...
Tears of happiness.
Tears of happiness. You know, the love, the care, the ups and downs. You know, it hasn't been easy, I'm sure, at times. But how amazing is that? And I would say to people, you know, if you think that you can care for a child and give a positive, make a positive difference in a child's life, not just your own, but your own family's life. The Tulsa are very interested. They have a free phone number here, 1800-226-771 or else fostering.ie. Now, we'll put all that up on the Countrywide website. And as I said, they are struggling with COVID, with recruiting new foster carers. There's always a need. You heard the wonderful family there in Monaghan. And as I said, it's fostering.ie.
Fostering.ie. Lovely report there, Brenda. Hope you enjoyed your trip up to County Monaghan. And good morning to all the Bradys and everybody around Ahabog there this morning. It was great to have you on Countrywide. Yeah, I was just reading Tony Connolly, our Europe correspondent, last night. He was saying that it's understood that 95% of the EU-UK future relationships treaty has been completed as part of the Brexit talks, but there remains large gaps on key stumbling blocks, including fisheries and how disputes will be solved. And the Minister for Foreign Affairs, Simon Coveney, has added a note of caution that there is no certainty of a trade deal that it will be agreed by the 31st of deadlines. Yet we're entering another week, another crucial week of Brexit. How long have we been saying that? But again, it is the next week. Next 2 weeks are going to be crucial. And I received a letter during the week from Jim McQueenie in Sligo, and he said, Damien, some time ago in the past, you had Seamus O'Rourke on talking about the hard border. Would there be any chance that you could replay that on a future programme? Well, Jim McQueenie in a county, Donegal actually, in Ballyshannon in County Donegal, your wish is our command.
The border between Northern Ireland and the Republic was great for going across and getting good value. The thought of coming home with unsmuggled goods makes me so sad. You can call Amazon and IKEA, but they have no idea how good it feels to get cheap toilet rolls from Northern Ireland, or wine, or baling twine, or Christmas decorations. There was a time you could fill the Mazda with stuff from Mazda for a fiver, and now it's no cheaper, so we must dig deeper if we're going to continue smuggling. We in Leitrim enjoy a good, tough embargo, because then we don't have far to go to break the law. We grew up smuggling sugar and butter and home heating oil. Well, you have to be cheating somebody. There's no comedy in shopping at Tesco. Let's go with a hard border for sneaking over late at night or early morning, fill the car with condoms and Rice Krispies and gin and vodka and little small bottles of beer from Belgium and toys for the grandchildren and marigolds for the missus or whoever washes the dishes in your life. Theresa May had her day with this whole border issue, and now Boris Johnston is completely out of his box. But wouldn't we fairly outfox the DUP if we went across the border some night and agreed to everything? Sinn Féin would make some gain if there was a nice low wall built between Ballyconnell and Derrylin, and then we'd knock wee holes in that wall and sneak over at night for cheap cheese and dog food. We in Leitrim want a hard border with low walls and little holes that we can look out through, and we want the government of this country to put up the price of everything, so that we can get back to smuggling and crawling through hedges and shoss late at night, and when we put the dinner on the table this Christmas, that it'll look like we earned it. We want our Christmas jumper to be full of flitters, and our Christmas slippers just a little bit soggy from tramping through wet, boggy northern Irish fields. We want our Christmas table to be full of illegally sourced produce. We want to have a head full of thorns. We want it to look like we went to South Armagh for the schlore, that we marched down the Garvahy Road for cheap cranberry sauce, and that the hole in the turkey's arse was put there by an incendiary device. There's no crack shopping anymore. We want adventure. Make it harder to buy cheap shite that we'll never use. Make rules that we can break. Give us something to do, for Jesus' sake, instead of sitting looking at our phones. The phones don't work in Leitrim. There's no signal. The only thing that works on the phone is the calculator, and sooner or later we're all going to disappear into the Christmas trees that they've planted all over our county. The only thing we're good at is smuggling and saying nothing. Well, one of them's going to have to stop. Help the North West this Christmas. Bring back smuggling. We want a hard border.
Never gets old, stood the test of time, and it's still relevant. That was first broadcast, I think, Janie, maybe a year ago on here on RTÉ Radio 1. That's Seamus O'Rourke. That piece, as I said, was actually requested by one of our listeners, Jim in Ballyshannon. So I hope you enjoyed that again, Jim. By the way, Seamus O'Rourke's new book, Standing in Gaps, a must read, is fresh off the presses. It's on sale now. So just go to SeamusO'Rourke.com for more details. You can buy it direct from him, or there's a list of outlets selling it. It really is a tremendous read, and we had Seamus in a few weeks ago telling us about it. Now, according to recent research, Irish farmers are 7 times more likely to die from cardiovascular related disease than those with salary paid occupations. This, of course, is alongside the fact that it is the most dangerous occupation to actually work in. Well, Alison Holmes is from County Laois, but practices as a physiotherapist. She's from a farm as well, and she's just completed some research as part of her Nuffield scholarship into the health and well-being of Irish farmers, and she joins me now. Good morning, Alison.
Good morning. Thanks very much for having me on.
There's a slight delay there, but I'll continue anyway. Tell me a little bit more about your own farming and healthcare backgrounds combined, and what prompted you to focus on farm health for the Nuffield?
Yeah, so I'm farming in partnership with my dad in County Laois, my dad Brian, and we have a dairy and a beef enterprise here. And then I also work as a physiotherapist, and a couple of years ago I took a job in the School of Allied Health in Limerick to try and kind of develop more research-based skills and try and learn to integrate research into clinical practice. But I suppose when I was working in the hospitals, I would have seen a large proportion of people coming through our stroke unit and our cardiovascular programs with a background in farming. And it kind of just triggered something like, we're supposed to have this nice, active, healthy lifestyle, but maybe farmers aren't as healthy as we think they are. And what kind of impact is that going to have on the industry going forward, especially considering maybe the age profile of Irish farmers? So I suppose I was looking for opportunities to do some more research into this area, and then Nuffield kind of came up. I thought it was a really good platform to be able to investigate this topic further, and I had the privilege of being awarded a 2019 scholarship, which allowed me to do just that.
And as part of the scholarship research investigating the health and fitness of the fitness of farmers, what were your key findings, Alison?
Yeah, so I suppose the key findings were, first of all, we're kind of looking at what was going on in Ireland. So key findings were that, like, Irish farmers have disproportionate amount of health burden compared to their peers. They have very high incidences of cardiovascular disease, like you'd mentioned there in the intro. other things that came up was that the levels of health literacy was very poor in Irish farmers, especially in regard to nutrition, which I suppose is a little bit ironic considering that we're the major food producers. Other things that, like, you know, we all know there's lots of external stressors and uncontrollable factors that are aligned with farming, and this was obviously having an impact on well-being and therefore physical health as well. And these were all kind of major things coming up in Ireland, combined with the fact that lots of farmers work in isolation, and that would have an impact on health too. But I suppose when we started travelling, it became obvious that this is an international problem, and lots of countries have done lots of really positive things to start addressing it. So, such as the National Centre for Farmer Health in Australia, where they have a farmer hub that's aligned with Deakin University. So they're doing lots of research, but they have a great platform to be able to put that into practice straight away and make sure that all that knowledge transfer goes through to farmers. And there was just loads of really good examples of things that we could do a little bit better here, or incorporate farmer health and wellbeing training into lots of educational models. So that was a big one that kind of came up a lot in both in Australia and the UK, in terms of how they successfully improved farmer health, was to incorporate all that education into existing models. And, you know, it's great. I recently heard Minister Hayden say he'd been secured about 14 million for farmer training for next year, and he was hoping to include the area of farmer health and wellbeing into this. So it'd be great to see kind of a national approach to that. We have lots of great community groups in Ireland who've devised really good community-based initiatives. But again, it would be great to see this kind of being looked at a more national platform with a national rollout.
Yeah, you said there you travelled, and this was obviously pre-COVID, and that's part of your scholarship. You get a bursary to travel and do your research in other countries. Like you said there, that there's a lot of comparisons with Ireland, that farmers, they don't have regular working hours. They're just working morning, noon and night. They don't have a proper working week, like unlike the 9-to-5s in this world. But are there countries where there is this good work-life balance? Denmark, I think, for example, has a good structure in place for farmers. Am I right?
Yeah, so Scandinavia, I'd actually hoped to travel there. I was supposed to go in May, but COVID didn't allow it. But Scandinavia take kind of an overall, I suppose, a slightly different approach to the health and well-being and the work-life balance. And they have things like enforced annual leave for farmers, and you're not really allowed to draw down a lot of your entitlements unless you're showing proof of that you're kind of looking after yourself and self-management and well-being as well. And I suppose there's scope there for things like that. Like in the UK, they also align some of those with the Red Tractor Initiative, which is similar to our Board BIA audits. So some of the recommendations coming out of the report that I've written were that perhaps we could align kind of prompts for farmers and in regards to farmer health with schemes that they have to take part in, such as Board BIA, or some other countries have them aligned with maybe some of their single farm payments or CAP initiatives. But again, it's just to try and create that awareness and to try and get farmers to look after their own health and to seek kind of to seek health professionals, because health seeking behaviours is very poor in this cohort. I think they think they're all supermen and, you know, they just kind of get on with it. Yeah. Whereas sometimes, you know, you just have to take that little bit of time out and really look after your health and spot the problems early before they become problems and take that kind of positive and progressive approach.
Yeah, and there are a lot of agricultural courses around the country, varying from degree courses to Chagas courses and across the board. And farmers, people, prospective farmers, the young students, they go there, they learn everything about animal husbandry and about business and all of that. Do you think that maybe an element of health and well-being should be put onto those courses as well? Is that one of your recommendations?
Yeah, definitely. It was one of the main recommendations. So I heard over time and time again that farmers tend to prioritise the health of their animals over their own. And when you look at kind of other professions, most of them would have modules built in on self-management, managing their own health and well-being. Because if you're seen to do that, generally you run a better business, you run a better kind of more progressive system. So even just from a point of view of future-proofing the agricultural industry, I think it's really important that farmer health, well-being and self-management modules are built into existing programmes for agricultural students and ongoing programmes for farmers, such as discussion groups and knowledge transfer. This is the best way to try and access those farmers. They're already engaged with these programmes, and it's a way of incorporating this extra education in.
Okay, it's very interesting. I've read your executive summary and it really makes for very, very interesting reading, Alison. And the Nuffield Ireland Lunch and Learn series runs all week, featuring a 10-minute presentation at 1:30 each day outlining the key findings of each of the scholars, you being one of them, this week. And to register, you can go to nuffield.ie lunch and learn. nuffield.ie/lunch and learn. Alison, thanks so much for joining us. Okay, there's a bit of a delay there. I think she heard that. Alison Holmes there in County Leash. Now, according to new figures released by Bord Bia this week, we're cracked mad about eggs, with consumption of eggs up by 11% more than in the last 12 months. Now, in fact, we've consumed over 650 million eggs over the last year. But you can boil them, you can fry them, you can poach them, or you can scramble them. The versatile egg is, of course, a key ingredient in home baking, which more and more of us have taken up during the various lockdowns this year. It's 10 a.m. on Friday morning, and I'm here in Mulla, County Cavan. And Margaret Farley's free-range hens have just finished their breakfast and are heading out for a wander across the fields.
Well, this is Clonarn Mulla, just on the Cavan Mead border, Damien. And this is your first time here, so welcome.
Margaret, along with her husband Leo, started in the egg business in 1988 with 150 hens on their small dairy holding. Today, there are over 200,000 hens here and across other producer farms supplying the Margaret's Egg brand.
Most of the eggs are produced in Counties Cavan and Monaghan. We have a couple of farms in Meath and a couple in, and one in Longford. The eggs have to be brought in to us twice a week for grading, and they go into retail, most of them. Flock numbers vary from 2,800 to 10,000 birds in a flock. 10,000 seems a big number, but in fact it's not in modern day terms. Much, much bigger houses are being built at the moment for free range.
So you're completely free range, are you?
Yes, we made a decision in 1993 to stay free range and free range only. All of our competitors have going through their packing centres would have all types of eggs, organic, free-range, caged eggs and barred eggs.
So how many eggs are laid here where we are now on the home farm on a given day?
Well, we would expect, these birds are 35 weeks of age and they're laying at their prime now. So we would be expecting to get about 93% at this stage, and we have between the two houses we have 8,500 birds. It takes about 24 hours, maybe 26, to make an egg, and so all the time when we are looking at these hens here, there's an egg developing inside. They've just laid one, 40 minutes later they start making the next one, and that process goes on until the egg is laid the following morning.
So they'd be laying around six eggs a week
when they're at their peak.
Nice. Down south in County Cork, it's a similar story with Riverview Eggs.
Welcome, Damien. Welcome to Riverview Eggs. We're based here in Watergrass Hill in County Cork.
Well, back in 1966, Margaret Kelleher, along with her husband Danjo, decided to diversify their dairy and beef farm into egg production at White's Cross, just outside Cork City.
So I'm going to introduce you to the matriarch of the business, my mother, Mrs. Margaret Kelleher. Here she is.
Margaret, how are you? Pleased to meet you.
Thank you, Inver. Great to see you too.
It's a long time ago, 1965, we were married, and we got our first hens in June 1966. From there on, and I suppose it was a big adventure at the time. I remember the neighbours were saying, how could you have so many hens inside in the house? And from there then, the next year, there was the old hen house, as we used to call it, and we put more hens into that then, because we used to have a joke about it, like, what'll we do with it? And so from there on, it grew, really. Well, my husband, Danjo, he was great, and when we had mooted this idea about hens, he said, we'll go for it. And I suppose we were lucky. We had no hiccups along the way, we had no disease, there was no... You'd have to be so careful, make sure they have water, they have food. Because I remember one Sunday, and the children was collect on a Sunday when we were out in Watergrass Hill when we had another house there, and they were saying, we'll go after Mass. And anyway, I said, Cripes, no, we'll go up now. And luckily we did, because there was two lines of hens without water. And if we hadn't gone out that morning to check, like, the hens would be dead in 3 or 4 hours.
And that could have been the end of your business, wouldn't it?
Well, it could be.
And fast forward to today. Those children continue to be involved in the family business, which is now headquartered with a packing and distribution centre in Watergrass Hill and run by Margaret's son, DJ.
The eggs that you see being packed here now came in overnight from the farms. They'll be inside in the supermarkets this afternoon and tomorrow morning.
And how many eggs are you packing here on a weekly basis?
we're packing over 1 million eggs a week here. We have 13 producers, predominantly here in Munster. So, like, we would have just shy of 500,000 hens that we're taking production from. Well, the eggs come in, as one might call it, the raw material. They're ungraded from the farms, and then they're put through the egg grading machine here, which weighs every single individual egg, and then puts the traceability information and the Bord Bia logo onto the individual egg, puts it into the pack. The pack is then closed, and more information is put onto the outside of the pack so that the consumer can read that in the instant that they're purchasing it on shelf. Those eggs are going into depot this afternoon, and they'll be inside in the shops this evening. You're given 28 days from date of lay. So date of lay starts the minute the hen lays the egg on the farm. So that's why we strive to get the eggs in every day from each farm.
These eggs are sourced from a number of mainly local-based producers.
Yeah, well, Damien, as you saw, we only travelled half a kilometre from the packing centre. This is our closest production farm that we have, which is owned by my husband, Fintan Foley.
We're producing eggs every day. Obviously, the hen will lay one every day, and the eggs are collected every day, and they'll be in the shops tonight. Yeah, they come into me about 17 weeks old. They take about 2 or 3 weeks to settle down. They start laying about 20 weeks, and at that stage, you're up to about 95% production. They stay here until around 80, 84 weeks, because as the hen gets older, the egg shell thins and the quality diminishes. And that's about 84 weeks, roughly, maximum.
2020 has been a roller coaster year for the egg business. Even though food service shut down, demand jumped up in shops and supermarkets as we cooked and baked more using eggs.
On the back of that, like, we saw it happening in March, April, where everybody was at home. They were baking, they were cooking, but they were also realising the value and the versatility of an egg in being able to make a meal. You know, eggs are versatile and they will feed your family on a budget.
Absolutely, and that's wonderful. Wonderful for the industry, wonderful for us, because the rising tide lifts all boats, I suppose, and we get our share. But we'd love you to be eating more of them, using more of them, of course. We'll never say enough is enough.
Enough is enough, of course.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's something.
Exactly. God, I'm such a child. If anybody has intermediate French, they will get that last little bit of giggling there that went on between myself and Margaret Farley of Margaret's Eggs in Mullen, County Cavan. And before that, another Margaret and another woman entrepreneur ahead of her time. That was Margaret Kelleher and her son DJ Kelleher and Fintan Foley of Riverview Eggs in Watergrass Hill in County Cork. We've a tweet here to finish the programme. A tweet, yeah, hens and all that and birds. And the background noise from the egg segment is gas. Sounds like the British House of Commons. That's a tweet from one of our listeners. Thank you very much indeed for that, bringing the programme to an end for this week, which was produced by Eileen Herron. Brian Moss was our broadcast coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound. Don't forget Ear to the Ground on RT1 TV on Thursday at 8:30. And stay tuned for playback after the 9 news here on Radio 1. I'd like to talk to you at the same time next week. Bye bye, and thanks for listening.